Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and we're streaming live at kuci.org. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Ivy Pacoda, the author of the critically acclaimed novels Wonder Valley and Visitation Street. Wonder Valley won the 2018 Strand Critics Award for Best Novel and was a finalist in the LA Times Book Prize, as well as an NPR and Los Angeles Times Book of the Year. Visitation Street won the Prix Page America in France and was chosen as an Amazon Best Book of the Month, Amazon Best Book of 2013, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection. Her books have been translated into 5 languages. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. Her first novel, The Art of Disappearing, was published by St. Martin's Press in 2009. She teaches creative writing at the Studio 526 Skid Row. She's here to talk about her fourth novel, These Women, published by Echo. Thanks for returning to the show, Ivy.
It's always such a pleasure to be here and to talk to you.
Well, let's begin with you talking about the origins of These Women. What inspired it?
Well, it was inspired by a couple of things. The first of them was for a while, I used to live downtown in the Arts District in Los Angeles, and I moved to a neighborhood in the center of the city called West Adams, in the Harvard Heights section of West Adams. And I decided to run for a seat on my local neighborhood council. And I was voted on by, I got 9 votes and ran unopposed. And I only served 2 years of my 4-year term. I travel too much for my job and my husband's job to really serve the community properly. But during that time, I learned a lot about the neighborhood, and I learned about some of the economic, racial, and, you know, fissures in it, and also some of the racial and economic unities within it. And I also just became aware of a lot of the sort of grassroots organization in West Adams. And one of the things, you know, the neighborhood council had a lot of various things brought before it, many of which to do with preservation. And there's a lot of disagreement. You know, some people think preservation is a must for the neighborhood, and other people think that it inhibits a certain level of progress. Not that they want, you know, big skyscrapers, but like, you know, if someone wants to have a daycare in their house, they can't put a sign outside because that's against, you know, neighborhood ordinance. So there's a lot of things that people disagreed about. But one thing that everyone agreed about was the issue of prostitution. And there are a lot of prostitutes on Western Avenue, which sort of is at the edge of our community, and or runs right down the middle, actually. And, you know, it struck me that everyone sort of was quite happy to blame the prostitutes for the problem, where and I was sort of shocked that this very civic and moral and human and, you know, grassroots group of people really were so negative about the women who, you know, worked Western. I have a very different attitude towards prostitution, having worked in Skid Row for years and know a bunch of women who work in that profession, and also living in Amsterdam, you know, it's not a woman's choice sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that it was something that I wanted to write about. And the other thing that inspired me was, of course, the serial killer named the Grim Sleeper, who whose case was being sort of written about in the press, and who was arrested when I first moved to Los Angeles. So that was sort of in the back of my mind. And then learning all this stuff about, you know, the neighborhood and the prostitution problem, I realized, you know, I had a story to marry these two interests together.
Wow. So were you working on Wonder Valley from your West Adams home as well?
I mean,
point did this idea come up? Were you working on Wonder Valley when it started to gel, or how did that go?
Yeah, I think I was, actually. I think I was pretty much in the end stages of writing Wonder Valley. And of course I was, because sorry. I have a much better answer now. When I was writing Wonder Valley, I decided to watch this documentary called Tales of the Grim Sleeper by the English documentarian Nick Broomfield, who makes a lot of great documentaries, including, I believe, he made Taxi to the Dark, From the Dark Side, about rendition. And Tales of the Grim Sleeper, he goes to investigate. He's a very posh, erudite Englishman, and he goes to like deep, like down western to like the 60s to 90s in LA, which is south, the heart of South Central, to really look into these murders that were attributed to a man named Lonnie Franklin, who hadn't been arrested when he started to make the documentary. And he interviews a lot. Of Lonnie's friends in the course of the documentary. And I watched it when I was writing Wonder Valley because I wanted to hear. I'm not from LA, and I wanted to hear how a certain type of person who lives in Los Angeles talks, specifically Black Angelenos who've come up from the South. It's a particular dialect and dialogue that I'm not familiar with, but I heard it in Skid Row a lot, and I wanted to make sure I had it. So I watched the documentary, and I was really taken by a moment in the documentary where you realize that his friends, the Molly Franklin, the murderer, serial killer's friends, knew something was up with him. And that's when I had the idea that I wanted to write about it.
Interesting. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that with your neighborhood because, I mean, in part, you know, there's a lot of research there you don't have to do. But then the other part of that is you're writing about prostitutes, of which you are not a prostitute. And so what kind of research then did you do about prostitutes and prostitution?
Yeah.
And what goes on there?
Well, not a lot, actually. You know, the documentary, Nick Broomfield did it all for me. It was really helpful. The main voice in the documentary is a woman named Pamela Brown, who sort of functions as Nick Broomfield's guide around the neighborhood, because he just can't go marching in there with his, you know, team of, you know, English, you know, camera and sound people. And she's an ex-prostitute. And she's also not a victim of the Grim Sleeper, but knows a lot of them. And she just had this amazing voice. And it just really stuck with me. And, you know, she talks about what it was like being a prostitute. She talks about, you know, how she can't get a job because she has a rap sheet. So that really was just hearing her voice, you know, I sort of was able to sort of internalize some of what I thought, you know, prostitute would think about. There's tons of documentaries about prostitution out there. I did live in Amsterdam for 7 years, and you know, prostitution is legal and it's not really frowned upon. And you know, you do know people who work as prostitutes. Like I have several friends on Facebook, women I knew when I lived there who had retired from the business. So I knew them pretty well. And every once in a while you'll be out at a party and suddenly you'll realize, oh, I know what you do for a living. And then there's a woman who is in my Skid Row writing workshop who is a prostitute. And I didn't know that until I watched a documentary about Skid Row just out of curiosity. And I saw her interviewed and I realized, of course, that's what she did. Mm-hmm. So I knew what she was like on the everyday, day-to-day basis. And then I also realized that she was a prostitute. So I realized, you know, they're just women with jobs and they right. probably are like anybody else on a daily basis.
Right, right. So, I mean, there are so many serial killer narratives out there, but your book focuses on the victims. Your novel focuses on the victims. And maybe talk a little bit about that, because that's sort of it's a real different slant from what I've seen.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't like I set out to say, okay, these are terrible. You know, I'm not interested in serial killers. So, you know, I didn't mean to write about a serial killer. When I watched this documentary about Lonnie Franklin, what interested me were the people around him, right? Mm-hmm. So his friends, Nick Broomfield interviews his friends, and they all say that, you know, old chestnut, well, Lonnie was the nicest guy and he'd do anything for you. It was always he would do anything for you. It was like he'd steal a car part for you. But they kept saying that, like, if you needed a carburetor, he got it for you. You know, your car broke down, he'd get you what you needed. He always came through. But he was a stand-up guy. And in the course of the documentary, his friends flip and they say, well, you know, he had all this weird stuff in his car that was like, you know, photographs of women who'd been tied up, or, you know, he said he'd like to do some freaky stuff to women. And then they just real kind of admit that, you know, they knew that he was up to something. And then the same goes for Lonnie Franklin's son's girlfriend, who's living in the house, who says he's a great guy, he's wonderful, but, you know, he had some perversions. So I was really taken, especially with the girlfriend of his son, what it was like to live in the presence of this extreme violence, you know, and in extreme denial of this violence. Like, she lived in this house for many, many years. Lonnie Franklin's wife lives in the house. It was pretty clear he was torturing women in the back. So I didn't really ever want to write about a serial killer. I really wanted to write about the people who live in his orbit. So it just by chance became about the victims, because I feel like when you have a criminal, we always look at like the victim who's left for dead on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. But we don't really consider that, like, it's also a victimization to have your wife, you know, living with you when you're saying you're doing one thing, but you're off, you know, killing people. That woman is living in the presence of extreme violence. Your daughter is living in the presence of extreme violence. So just by wanting to write about his orbit, it became a victim forward book, as they say. You know, I'm never going to write a traditional crime novel. You must know that by now. and like, far be it from me to write a serial killer novel. I mean, there are far too many of those, and the ones that are good are so excellent, you know, and they understand the pathology and the psychology and the forensics and the, you know, all that stuff. That's not for me. So, like, let's talk about the people who are left behind.
Yeah, and I think you said, I've heard you say that you were writing a crime adjacent novel.
That's what they tell me.
I love that. I mean, because yeah, it's not your traditional murder mystery or traditional thriller, but it's, well, I mean, it's my favorite genre. What you're doing, it's,
yeah. You know, thanks.
It's good writing.
We all live crime adjacent lives. You know, like, we're all, you know, some of us come closer to crime. Some people are involved in them. Some of the family members are victims of crimes. But, like, crime adjacent is, like, you know, our lives are lived in the specter of violence, you know, for a lot of the time, or in the shadow of violence, or in the potential, you know, sphere of violence. So I'm always interested in, like, bring those things coming closer, or how close we can come to these, you know, horrible. I'm always shocked that we're also lucky to not have these horrible experiences. So my fiction sort of toes in and out of that world. You know, it's always about the ripple effect of the violence rather than, like, you know, the whodunit of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you said about Visitation Street that your second novel, that you, you know, tell me if I got this wrong, you thought it was literary fiction, but your agent or your editor said, no, you're writing crime fiction. And then there was the Dennis Lehane imprint and a surprise to you.
Oh, it was a huge surprise. I mean, like, I thought I sold it as literary fiction to a literary imprint, to a literary agent, to a literary editor. And then she called me and she showed me the cover. I was like, that's a pretty cool cover, but, you know, it's really dark. And she said, well, and this is even before they sent it to Dennis Lehane, she said, you know, what would you think about this cover, the big old quote from Dennis Lehane on it? And I thought, well, I mean, he's a big deal, but, like, why would he blurb my book? And she said, well, if you wrote a crime novel, why wouldn't he blurb it? And it was literally the first I'd ever heard of it. I remember exactly where I was standing at the moment. I was standing upstairs in my loft and just, like, completely blindsided. She said, well, what do you think? A girl went missing on the first page, and then you find out what happened to her in the last page. That's a mystery. And I thought, well, I guess it is. You know, Dennis Lehane also does not think it's a mystery, and he was very confused. We went and did a couple events together, like two or three, and people kept asking about this mystery novel, and he kept turning to me and saying, like, why are they asking about this? I said, well, you blurbed it, and they think of the crime novel. He's like whispering to me. He's like, well, it's not, is it? I was like, I don't think so. But, like, keep talking.
Well, apart from that wonderful blurb, did you have any misgivings being thought of as a crime novelist? I mean, if you'd been thinking of yourself as a literary fiction novelist, and now they're saying, no, you're writing crime fiction. I mean, what did that feel like?
Yeah, I had a huge amount of misgivings about it. I still do, not because I think it's a bad thing, but I feel like I'm always about to disappoint somebody. And you know, it happens. Like, people read my books and they're like, well, this isn't a thriller. You know, this isn't a, because like we have these terms that pigeonhole things, you know, thriller. Right. Like, what is a thriller? Like, they call Lee Child a thriller writer. They call Gillian Flynn a thriller writer. They call, you know, me a thriller writer. They call, you know, the woman who wrote, I'm going to butcher her name, so we're not going to say it. Night Film, Masha Peschel, a thriller writer, you know? But I think like when someone picks up a thriller, they want like, you know, a true beach read, rip through it book, or like, you know, Jack Reacher. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of misgivings about not being able to satisfy the designation or the box that I was put in. I also, you know, of course was concerned where I didn't know anything about the community, and it's an amazing place to be. And I could not be any happier being in the mystery and crime world. I mean, the people, especially the women, well, the men are very generous too, but it's an incredible group of strong women mm-hmm. writing some kick-ass books. But, you know, we in the mystery and thriller community, we read very widely. Like if you follow Megan Abbott, Laura Littman, many people, you know, on Twitter or Instagram, they read across genres. Attica Locke is one of the most like prolific readers I know, and they you know, tell you what they're reading, and it's really, really widespread. It doesn't work the other way around. You don't see, you know, a lot of highbrow literary writers saying, oh, I just love the new Attica Locke book. I love the new, you know, Alethear Burke book. And it's really sort of heartbreaking to me, because that's not a two-way street, and it really should be, because some of the work being done in the thriller community is some of the most important social justice writing that I've read, like Steph Chaw's books, Attica's books, like even some of Michael Connelly and definitely Walter Mosley's books mm-hmm. are going into communities and investigating problems that we're not seeing in literary fiction, you know?
Right.
It's just taken for granted that a crime novel is going to go into different communities. My misgiving is not about being in the crime community. It's about the literary community's sort of somewhat disregard for it. It bums me out, frankly.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. When I talk about certain novels and people I know who just write literary fiction kind of look at me like, oh, why should I read that? I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah. I know. It's crazy. I just really think that you know, every once in a while, there's that smart mystery that comes out that people are willing to read, you know, it's very ghettoizing in a certain way. And it's like, we can all learn from genre books, because genre books are very tightly constructed. You know, there's not a lot of room for mistakes in a genre book. So like, if you can do that, you know, I think like MFA programs should look at the structure of genre books, because it gives you an amazing framework for doing stuff. And then you can break the mold, you know, but like, let's start with the basics and then break the mold.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ivy Pakoda. Her book is These Women, published by Echo. Will you read from the book?
Sure. It's always a little tricky to read this for live radio, because it's got some bad sections. But I found this is one of my favorite sections. We are following a woman named Dorian, and Dorian lives in my neighborhood, and she's walking from her, fish shack. She's walking home at night, and her daughter was murdered about 15 years ago, so she is thinking about that. It's never far from her mind.
Okay.
And this is sort of an homage to my neighborhood. So she continues north past the odd assortment of independent shops: Martin's Fishing Tackle, Crown and Glory Hair Design, Queensway Beauty Supply, a barber shop, two water refill stations, three Pentecostal churches, and a laundromat, all surviving between the strip malls that are eating up Western. You'd think there weren't customers enough for another budget cell phone place, knockoff chain pizzeria, donut shop. But the city, especially south of the 10, seems to have an insatiable appetite for the same stores sloppily reproduced. It's just over a mile to her house, the last uphill stretch giving the neighborhood surrounding the 10 the title of Heights: Western Heights, Arlington Heights, Harvard Heights, Kinney Heights. The houses grow grander on the incline, 3,000 to 5,000 square foot Craftsman, Victorian, and Beaux-Art homes, not to mention the row of oddball mansions lined up on Adams Boulevard. From the business corridors like Western, it's hard to see the neighborhood's old grandeur. hard to see how West Adams and all its constituent neighborhoods were once upscale and desirable. That was before Los Angeles lifted restrictions on non-white home ownership, moving the city's focus farther north and west. And once Blacks moved in, staking their claim in a genteel hood in the middle of town, city planners didn't think twice about where to put the 10 connecting downtown to the beach. They laid it right in the middle of West Adams, creating a 500-foot-wide gully obscuring one part of the neighborhood from the other and tearing down houses like they were raising a rainforest. And as an aftermath, or rather an afterthought, some of the most beautiful houses in Los Angeles have a tidal wave of traffic or a stagnant sea of red and white lights in their backyards. The houses that remain unsettle Dorian, reminding her of how fast the city can turn its back. Dorian's not a neighborhood booster. She understands why people don't want to live in West Adams, why they can't envision a life for themselves between Boost Mobile, Cricket Mobile, and Yang's Donuts. Why they don't want to live next to a once beautiful home chopped up into a boarding house with too many occupants and a warren of rooms. She knows why folks pass up the opportunity to own a pristine bungalow or a rambling six-bedroom mansion on the wrong side of the 10. Still, every year there's more and more chatter about the neighborhood coming up, about how it's the last great value in Los Angeles, the last place to buy a substantial house and be part of an actual community. But tell that to the guy who got murdered in front of Moon Pie Pizza on Western and Adams, or the bartender who got shot at Lupio's and Western by Pico, or the dozens of stray cats flattened by boys drag racing their steroidal Nissans up and down the residential blocks. Dorian's breathing heavy by the time she reaches the 10. She stops before crossing over the freeway. In the triangular strip between the eastbound on-ramp and the street where the girls have a regular beat, someone has opened a nursery. Dorian peers through the chicken wire at the plants in their pots, some woven on 3x3-foot square trellises and lashed to the fence and choking on freeway exhaust. There are pencil plants and other succulents, a few cacti, some shrubs, roses, as well as California natives, wild geraniums, sages, and asters that will attract birds. Soon, she imagines, finches, hummingbirds, and even orioles will swarm this grim plot next to the 10. There's a rustle in the air, and she braces for a gust of wind. But when she looks up, she sees a flock of green parrots tearing through the sky, the wild bird song cutting through the traffic noise in an unfettered melodic mania. Dorian cranes her neck, watching the birds swoop low, then rise as one, a multicolored storm funnel in the last light. Ever since she first spotted the swarm of parrots in her neighborhood, she's been hoping to lure them to the fish shack or to her house. But the parrots follow no discernible pattern, appearing for days, stirring up the sky and trees, shaking the palm fronds, chattering wildly, then taking their excitement elsewhere.
Thank you so much. That was Ivy Pakoda reading from These Women, published by Echo. I think I always talk to you about what I'm about to talk to you about when you come on the show, because it's one of the things I like so much about your books and about crime fiction, which is setting. Setting is a big deal in all of your work. And I wonder if you'd talk about that and how, what sort of part it plays for you.
I'm sorry, in terms of setting?
Yeah, in terms of setting. And because it's all throughout this book. I mean, the setting becomes the character in These Women.
You know, it's for me, it's just the easiest thing for me to write setting. It's sort of where my brain goes when I don't feel like writing. I know it's like an exercise, you know. We all have that thing we're good at. I was a professional athlete, and when I didn't feel like, I played squash and sort of like tennis. And I never liked to do the like boring shots. When I wanted to practice, I'd do all the fancy shots. I'd go on court and, you know, show off for myself. And it was really easy for me. But when it came to do the ground strokes, or, you know, I would refuse to do it. So like setting is that. It's like this flourish that just comes naturally when I don't feel like you know, digging into or character description, what people look like, I could do setting. But I really feel that, you know, I really wanted to write about this neighborhood. Like, you know, it's such a cliche. We always say it, that place is a character, but in this book, it really, really is. Because of, you know, the fabric of West Adams is so interesting to me. There are these beautiful
grand craftsman houses and Victorian houses. I mean, for people who can't envision it, you've seen it in every movie. It's the house in 6 Feet Under is near me, like 3 or 4 blocks away. The house in American Horror Story, the first season, that's also in my neighborhood. They're these really big houses. And the house in the comedy Neighbors is like the frat house, the house next door, these big sort of, so, but in the middle of that, there's this freeway, and then there are these, you know, LA big boulevards like Western and Arlington and Crenshaw, which are, you know, not so pleasant. They've got tire shops and, you know, mobile, I just read about it, like all of these sort of, you know, not so great businesses. And I just could not get out of my head, like this juxtaposition that's also reflected in the people who live there, you know? And it just was like, the story just seemed, the neighbor needed a story told about it, you know? Because it is sort of, the 10 freeway just cuts it in half. And I just, you know, it's like having the Grand Canyon in the middle of your neighborhood, like the far side of the 10 is like where many people in Los Angeles mind refuses to go, you know, they don't go south of the 10. So like, I was hoping in the book to sort of create the sort of liminal idea that Los Angeles for many people stops there and we stop caring at that point. You know, we don't care about people dying south of the 10, living south of the 10, whatever happens, it's like the Wild West.
Yeah. Are the places you write about real or fictional? Are some of them real and some of them fictional? I would think the fish shack is a fiction.
It's real. So it's like a lot of them are just amalgams of places. So there's a fish shack. There's two fish shacks that I think about when I think about Dorian's. The physical location is actually based on a Belizean restaurant that's on Western, a little bit north. It's on Western and like 28th, but it looks like that. Like in my mind, her restaurant looks like the thing called the Belizean Fish Shack or the Belizean Fish Restaurant. The Belizean Fish Restaurant, it's really good. It's kind of a neighborhood community place. They, you can get a whole fish to go. But there is, as you go a little bit further south and west and West Adams, there are a couple of fish shacks. There's one called Mel's Fish Shack, which is what Dorian serves, like more traditional, you know, fried fish. So I just sort of put those together. You know, the art gallery Morello works in or has a show in is loosely based on actually much better gallery called the Underground Museum, which would never show her work. Like, they're a legitimate place. But, you know, for many people, an idea of art galleries in that neighborhood is a little odd. So I sort of wanted to anchor it in something real. The Underground Museum is a absolutely wonderful Black-owned art gallery with one of the best bookstores. They would never show her work, for various reasons. so that's real. Where she works out and does her boxing, that exists. You know, in the bar, it's the bar Lupio's and Chabolita Tacos exist within spitting distance of my house. So they're all real. Yeah.
Interesting. So, I noticed, that there is a mudslide in this book and there was a flash flood in Wonder Valley. And are you a water sign?
yeah, actually I am. I'm an Aquarius.
there's water all over the place. And, you know, I mean, writers, we return to certain, I don't know, motifs or certain things in project after project. So I found that really interesting to find the mudslide.
Well, it's funny. You are the first person to mention a larger theme there, but my first book, The Art of Disappearing, which is a very weird book. And, you know, it's very different to the rest of my other work and, you know, kind of like a beginner novel. I didn't hit the ground running. I hit the ground, stumbled, and then had to start over. But a huge part of that book is about a girl who dreams about water all the time and like water flooding things. And her brother swims away in this ocean, never to be seen again. And then, of course, in Visitation Street, it opens with these girls taking a raft into the water. And it's a huge part of the book.
Yeah,
I'm obsessed with water. I'm not a great swimmer. I was actually talking to someone about this on the phone the other day, that water in dreams is a sign of emotion and that cannot be contained, like floods and stuff. And I think that maybe that's leaking into the books, like this lack of containment of like story and character and emotion.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just dreamt about water. I live near the beach and the water came up into the street, and I'm going to have to think about that. Yeah, because I'm thinking, what does this mean? It can't mean what, you know, anything so totally realistic and concrete. It has something else going on. So thank you for that. So these women is told from multiple points of view. Talk about that, deciding to do that, and then the particular women that you chose.
Well, you know, I can't go into too much detail because some of them will give the plot away, but I wanted to, we'll talk about the first couple. You know, the serial killer, that I was basing this on was, dormant, or supposedly dormant, for 15 years. I think he probably wasn't, but that's another story. So I wanted to find characters that could, you know, be in both parts of his, you know, reign of terror, the past and the present. So there's that. And I just wanted to, you know, as I said earlier, like, victimhood is not just the dead woman left behind. It is the, it's the, you know, sort of arena of, you know, violence and the all the people who live in his orbit. So I wanted to definitely have characters who are the people who he killed, obviously. But also I wanted to have, you know, people who are very close to him, you know, people who might not know, or people who would have to deny what they were living with. I wanted to have a range of characters who spans the, you know, racial and economic and, you know, spectrum. Women who both reflected acceptable and unacceptable society, because, you know, everyone's a victim in the book, and some victims we listen to, some we don't. So I just chose people who were representative of the voices we don't listen to, and the people we don't consider victims because their stories aren't worth telling, and the type of victims we might overlook.
Was there one in particular that you especially connected with or especially liked?
Oh my God, yeah. I love Juliana, you know, the dancer. I think it's fantastic. She's just so much fun to read. To read. It was just so much fun to write her, because it was the character in which it was, the whole theme of the book was so crystallized to me, that like, we, society would view her as an exotic dancer or possibly a prostitute one way, but like, she has this very rich inner life and she's struggling against it, and like, everything's stacked against her, but she's definitely the most interesting and the most dynamic, and she burns so bright and has this really fully realized, like, you know, vision and self assuredness, but also a profound awareness of like, how she is seen, you know, and all these micro elements. She just looks different than other people, you know. Her body, she's voluptuous and curvy, and like, this, that signifies certain things. And like, she can't, she goes to a party where there are a lot of hipster artist girls there, and she's just like, I don't fit in, like, not even if I'm dressed like them, I'm built for something else. So for her, like, I just really loved, she was just so much fun, and I felt so bad for her, but it was just a really fun, heartbreaking character to write, and just, she wrote herself. I mean, I'm sure everyone hates that, but it's true.
Well, who was the most difficult to write or live with or understand?
Dorian was damn impossible to write. I mean, I was in agony about it. Dorian's the character who opens the, not, Dorian's the character I read from. She is the first viewpoint in the book. There's a little interstitial character named Ophelia who comes and goes. She was a blast to write. But Dorian was really hard because she's old. I'm very, you know, aware that I can't really write. I try to write people around my age, you know, within 10 to 20 years. Maybe 10 to 15 years. Dorian's a lot older than I am. And, you know, she's been through a lot. She's lost a child. She's also a stagnant person. You know, she's sort of stuck in time. She's stuck in the past. She isn't going anywhere. She's sort of on a hamster wheel of grief and frustration. So the character is like naturally stagnant, you know, and that's not a lot of fun to write. And also she's grieving.
and she's older. And I was just really had a lot of trouble making her a person as opposed to just the sum of the things I just listed, like an older grieving mom who's stuck in place. Like, she needed to have a personality. It was so hard to get that through and unearth that underneath, you know, all the stuff that she was doing, you know. But when I did, it worked out. But it was just sort of, it was really hard to animate her. And because she comes so early in the book, she bears a lot of weight of the story, you know. So that was really hard.
You did it well. I really loved Dorian.
Thanks.
I really...
Well, it worked out in the end. There were moments where I was like, oh, no. This is awful.
Yeah, no.
And Juliana follows her, who's like an explosion of like light and excitement and all this stuff. And her voice is so vibrant. And Dorian's voice is by nature not particularly vibrant, you know, so...
Yeah, no, I thought she was great. And very early on, there's a red herring. And later, when the reader learns who the serial killer is, it makes sense. Mm. But it's not at all obvious. And I wondered if you consciously decided you needed a red herring. Or if that just part of telling a story. No?
No, not at all. I mean, of course, think it's so blatantly obvious who the serial killer is, but I'm always shocked when somebody doesn't get it. Though apparently I'm wrong. So, you know, it was difficult. You know, I'm just not like, I'm not like so excited about like the nuts and bolts of plot. Initially earlier in the book, you knew who it was really early on. Cause I was like, oh, well, I mean, I'm not interested in this part. Let's dispense with it. And then I changed it a little bit.
Why did you change it? I mean, do you have readers and someone said,
hey, better story.
It's
a- you know, I really drew a lot. You know what? It wasn't that I changed it. He was a bigger character earlier on who he is. And he was a different character. He's a bigger character. And suddenly, it wasn't that I revealed it early, but there was this guy who was like sort of present in a lot of the story for no apparent reason. And then my editor was like, did you want to give that away so early? I said, well, I'm not particularly interested in it because I'm more interested in the women orbiting him.
Right.
And then it doesn't seem necessary. It's just like a big flashing like strobe light, like this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. And so I just peeled back and I realized the less that I was so uninterested in him that I hid it really well because I didn't really talk about him a lot. It was an accident.
Yeah. I thought it was someone else.
Yeah. I
and then I had to look back
great.
At early chapters and go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So then what I was, my follow-up question, I probably shouldn't even ask because I was going to ask you about, you know, red herrings because, you know, they play a big part in crime fiction. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with what a red herring is, it's a clue in the story that misleads readers. And so it sounds like you're not consciously trying to include those kind of elements, that it's just probably more organic in how you write.
Yeah. It is organic. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think sometimes those things just happen if you know your story really well. You know, I don't try to think, if you told me, like, go write a crime novel, you know, right? I would just, you know, I would be at loose ends, you know, it'd be a very upsetting conversation that we'd be having. But, you know, I think that's best left to the experts like Alifair and Attica, you know, they're so good at it. But the more you know your story, the more some of these things slide into place, you know. I was really confident in the story. Like, unlike my other books, I sort of knew what I wanted to do. I knew when I even peeled back more on not the focus on the killer, I realized that by making these decisions, I actually had the room to slot in some of the conventions of the genre too around it. I think it was a lot, yeah, but oh gosh, if you had to say like write a book with a red herring in it, I'd say, ooh, you know, it's gonna be a bad read.
So do you have, do you work from outline or do you have an extensive synopsis before you begin? It sounds in part that it's a process of discovery for you, that you're going to, you know, follow the story. But at the same time, when you have a crime going on in the story, then it seems that you need some sort of outline or plot. No?
I mean, I did outline this book. I posted it on Instagram when it came out. It's a post-it note on my computer. It's literally the five characters. And actually, the detective wasn't in it in the first go-round. So it just says, you know, Dorian, mother of a victim, Juliana, you know, possible victim going forward, exotic dancer. And then the two, Morella and Annika, I'm not going to say who they are. But and then I knew, I just had this note, and I said who they were, and I said this book is going to be written sequentially. Each character is going to have a section, and they're going to be sequential, and they're not going to toggle back and forth. We're going to finish one story and go into the next, like building blocks. But that's all I had. But I knew that someone was going to die in the about a third quarter of the way through, and then the case was going to be solved by the end, and that was enough for me. I never have an outline more than that, you know. Because, you know, I was just sort of, I wanted to take each character through a day or 2 days of her life. And that's all I knew I wanted to do. And then the days were going to add up, and then the story would be resolved by the end.
Hmm. Did you write it chronologically?
Yeah, I did. And then I had to go back because I added the detective in later, and then I added Ophelia in later, as an exercise to pass time when I didn't know what I was doing. So I wrote it. I wrote through Morella chronologically, and then I went back and put the detective in. There was a detective who was bouncing in and out of the narratives, but it was a man, and then I made it a woman. I didn't want to have a detective because it seemed too conventional, but then I realized a female detective could suffer some of the same issues as, let's say, an exotic dancer, of like mm-hmm. disregard and disrespect, and she could be reacting in the same way to the situation as some of the victims could be. So I had to go back and put that section in, but then I made it chronological. Then, yeah, I wrote straight through the end when I...
Yeah, yeah, and Detective Perry has her own set of challenges that she's dealing
Boy,
with.
Boy, does she. Yeah, everything from sure being, does. You know, vertically challenged to a past and a dud of a husband.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, what about writing multiple point of view novels? I mean, do you prefer it because you can cover a lot more ground? And I mean, it seems that apart from, you know, having characters that flesh out the story in different ways, they're also taking up pages. So you're not dealing with one point of view character for a whole novel.
I mean, how do people do that? I have no idea. I don't want to spend that much time with anybody in my head. I mean, I'll read about it, but I don't want to write it. You know, it is sort of a cheat at first that I just would bounce around because I didn't know where anything was going. And then I'm going to say that I don't believe in writer's block because there's always another way to tell a story. So and that doesn't mean I don't believe in getting stuck in a story, but I believe that there's always something to write. I love multiple viewpoints because we all see the world differently. So if you were to come to West Adams or Skid Row, which I also write about, we'd have two totally different takes on it. I'm very used to it there. It is mm-hmm. horrifying in many ways, but I'm accustomed to looking for the community and the certain moments of joy. I mean, I've been there a lot, but someone who's never been to Skid Row might be absolutely horrified and disgusted. Or someone else coming there might be one of these, you know, passionate humanitarians who is just blown away and overwhelmed and is crying, you know? Mm-hmm. So all of those are the same, all of those are valid ways to see the world. And in order to portray Skid Row or West Adams or my sliver of West Adams to the public, I think it's really important to have different takes on it. So if we're looking at it, not a neighborhood, but a serial killer, the way the mother of one of his victims is going to feel about the situation is a very different to what a potential victim or a survivor is going to feel, or a detective. So like, there isn't one story. It's like a circle or a globe. You know, everyone's looking at this fixed point from, you know, different points on the circumference. And in order to see that point clearly, we should look from different perspectives. That's why I write multi-perspective novels.
Hmm. You know, I'm curious, what drew you to teach at the Studio 526?
We haven't talked about this ever.
I don't think we have.
I used to live in the Arts District, which is on the far side of Skid Row.
Right.
And my health club is in downtown. And this one, in order to get from my house to the health club, where I play squash every day of the week, I had to commute through Skid Row
two to four times a day, straight up and down 6th Street and 7th Street, which is the hardest skid row. Mm-hmm. I did it on my bike. I did it in my car. Every once in a while I walked, and I just became very familiar with the streets there. And as I said earlier, I changed, my perspective changed from this like horrified outsider to someone who was very interested in the sense of community that, you know, that I revealed itself to me. And then one night I decided, I watched a documentary called Lost Angels, with a terrible title, but it's a really good hour-long documentary about Skid Row, narrated by Catherine Keener. And it's at the end with this sort of email if you want to get involved. And I wrote them an email, and literally the next day they said, do you want to come teach creative writing? It was called, the organization was called LAMP. It's now called The People Concern. And so, yeah, that's how I got involved. And I started doing it. I was sort of nervous. You know, I said, oh God, what did I get myself into at 1 a.m. last night? I better go see what that's all about, because I'm a terrible person if I don't. And it's great. I mean, I just participated in a conference 2 days ago. I'm no expert on homelessness at all, but an expert in narrative and the importance of story, in terms of understanding a community and also in terms of a community supporting itself. I participated in this conference called Design with Dignity, about like various architects responding to homelessness. And, you know, it's really interesting. So I'm not actively involved, but I still teach. Well, I would if we could go to the studio.
You've been doing it quite a while.
Mm-hmm. I know, like 7 or 8 years.
So what do you get from it? I mean, what happens for you that has enabled you to continue doing it all this time?
I love it. I mean, I love the people. My group has gotten quite small, but a very hardcore, solid group of 10 people. We're trying to expand it. I love seeing them. We're friends. I love voices and I love stories, and I feel that I hear too many of the same voices and too many of the same stories and the same types of stories all the time. And I can go to the studio and I teach my creative writing. And basically, I've done it for so long that sometimes we don't really write. We just sit around and have like chat hour, which much to the frustration of certain writers. But I just feel this complete like sense of stepping outside my world and my comfort zone. But also like I hear, you know, I've had a lot of experiences in my life, but none of them are like this. And I just, and no two stories you hear in Skid Row are the same. And I just love to hear what everyone's talking about and what they're getting involved in. And, you know, everyone there has a daily struggle and a daily triumph. And it's so rewarding to hear those, like someone's getting housed or someone's art is being shown at the Skid Row Arts Museum, or someone is DJing in the park for Bob Marley Day, or someone now has a, you know, permanent singing gig at a gospel church. And it's just like, it's so great to hear this stuff on a daily basis. You know, we're all so, you know, my husband's a TV writer and he talks about that all the time. And like, what's the struggle in the writer's room? And I'm like, oh, my book publicity, you know, and these are all, you know, whatever, you know, this is, of course, these are the things we're concerned with, but I'm worried about my daughter, you know? But you know, what I hear there is just so moving. And so it's important to me to hear these stories and then to participate in them and to help people tell their stories, because, you know, I believe that narrative is such a positive force in the sense that it allows people to envision the future as opposed to stagnating in place. So what I want people to keep telling their stories as they're going to get better. You know, the story is going to get better every day.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left. I've been with Ivy Pakoda. Her book is These Women, published by Echo. Do you have readers? Do you run your stuff by readers before it goes to your editor or agent, whoever gets it?
Hard no.
No, really?
No. My mom and my dad, you know, they're both very literary and literate people. So that doesn't sound as weird as the average person answering that question might say. My mother is a journalist and a magazine editor, and my father is a book publisher. Though my father being a book publisher does not mean he has the best ideas about my work, but he's a really good barometer of, you know, they don't let me slouch. But do I show it to friends and a writing group? No, because frankly, I know this is a horrible thing to say. I actually don't care about anyone's opinion in the early stages. You know, I'm still working stuff out. you know, I, for me, the less clamor in my head, the better. I don't understand how people work in television and get all these notes. I mean, it, for me, it's not like these things aren't up for debate. This is the book, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is, I don't care about your, like your way you would have told the story. This is my story. So until I get it all done, it's really hard to have a lot of any input. You know, I need a little, I don't really, you know, it would be very hard. I tried with Wonder Valley to be in a writer's group and I workshopped a section and this woman just like went nuts about how you couldn't hear the wings of a hawk taking off. And I was like, I am so done. Like, first of all, like you read 50 pages and that's all you care about. Like, stop. And B, yes, you can hear them. And I don't want to have this conversation. So I feel like, because I teach creative writing, I went to an MFA program. I also read submissions or various things. People just, it's very hard to find the reader who reads to help you. You know, that's what my parents do. People read to find whatever they would do differently in there. And like, I am someone who reacts very badly to that. Some people love that. And that's great. But for me, it's a terrible idea. Because then I'm like, I'm like so mad at this woman. I see her. She's a friend of a friend. I see her around all the time. I'm like, oh, God, that woman and the hawk. It's killer. It's like, it's 8 years later, I still remember this.
Yeah, I hear you. Well,
do you think if you're stuck, it's a good thing to do? I think if you're stuck, it's a good thing to do. The book I'm going to work on now, there's a particular person who I respect because of the work he does. And I think I'm going to send him pages early because I'm a little worried about what I'm working on. But like, it's not, I, he's not going to come back and say, well, you know, I don't really think that when they go to that bus, you know, she would sit next to the window because the sun sets on the left side of the bus. It's like, enough.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
What about reading fiction? Do you read fiction as you're writing or do you have to stay away from books?
I do. I read, you know, it's weird. I always want to say I'm reading a ton of important fiction. It is important, but I just wind up reading my friends' books all the time. It never ends. You know, there's always like, I just got one today. I was like, I'm not going to read anything besides research books. And then I got a new book from a friend. But yeah, I'm always reading fiction. It doesn't really, you know, sometimes I read some lighter stuff. And I don't mean like, try to read like easier to read stuff. I like to read stuff with a lot of plot when I'm writing because I don't like plot. I like to read stuff that's moving. Mm-hmm. And I find it's like, oh yeah, that's right. Something's happening. It's Kate Atkins' book. A lot of things are happening in this book. Like, do that, you know? But I don't feel like, I don't get anxious about reading other people's work when I'm writing. You know, I do my own thing. So it's not a big deal. And then I'm always reading someone's manuscript to help them out or blurb something. So never ends.
Yeah. No, I mean, so many writers say, oh, no, I can't read when I'm working on my own stuff. I just have to stay away. Or I read poetry or I read nonfiction.
But it
or,
takes so long to write a book. What if you didn't read books?
Right.
What are they doing?
Like, it does.
4 years to read this book and I didn't read fiction for 4 years. I don't believe them.
Well, we have to talk. We just have to talk about, before we go, we have to talk about writing during this time because we are, you know, a lot of us are pretty much still in some sort of lockdown or quarantine. This is what's the date today, July 31st, 2020. And so how's it been for you? I mean, are you being productive? Are you writing a lot? Is it just, you know, same old?
Well, I mean, I had a book come out so on May 19th, so I wasn't writing leading up to that. And then, you know, I have a 5-year-old, so it's been a little tricky, you know, as I live in LA, so school shut early. I decided to take the brunt of her homeschooling care on myself. And I have a side business in writing these young and middle grade books with Kobe Bryant, and I had another one. So I was revising that so many complications, as one might imagine, with that project. So that turned into more of a job than a creative process. That is done as of an hour ago. So that's why I was a little frazzled. But when you first called me and I said I'm putting out some fires, I was like looking at something in the book. I will start writing in September 1st, I decided. And I'm, you know, I'm going to do it. It's not the schedule I want. I like to write in the mornings, but I will start writing at 2 p.m. I will write until 5. So, and I, you know, I'm kind of, I feel like for me, the pandemic has allowed me to think a little clearer about what I want to do. Like, I've had a really long layoff from writing fiction or literary fiction. You know, I finished These Women, I don't know, a year ago or something, for the most part. And I haven't written seriously since then of my own work. And I thought pretty carefully about what I want to do. And it's given me the distance to really, I don't know the whole story, but I have a good first third in my head. I'm really getting excited. We'll see what happens. Talk to me in a year.
Well, you know, speaking of These Women, you know, recently, you know, being published, how has the touring been? I mean, I guess everything has been canceled and you're doing a lot of virtual events. And how is that? And does it sell books? I'm curious.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think sales are great. you know, sales are okay. We did as, I mean, in my book specifically, I know that it did as best as it could given the circumstances. I happen to really like the virtual events. You know, I feel that going forward, all tours should have both virtual and live events.
Yeah,
I think it's so great. Like, my in-laws have never been to a real book event before. I've done things in their meeting house. But like, and my uncle came, you know, people really come and it's the same experience in a certain way. There's a conversation and I really, really enjoy it. Like, you know, the other cool thing is like, I did, my tour got canceled. I mean, I was heartbroken. I love to go and see places and I was going to go to bookstores that I'd never been to in state. I was going to go to Wisconsin. I've never been to Wisconsin and Houston. I've never been to Houston, you know, it was like a big deal, this one for me. Like, I was getting asked to do like, you know, tour plus. Of course, that didn't happen, but I can now go to bookstores that didn't ask me the first go round because it's free. So I got emailed by Murder by the Beach in Delray Beach, Florida, which is a big crime bookstore. And they're like, we would love to have you, but you couldn't tour here. And I'm going next week or whatever, two weeks. So like, I love that. You know, that's so cool to me. And I think there is sort of like, I think there's this byproduct that's kind of neat. So my book is being reviewed in the Florida Sun Sentinel by Olene Cogdill, who's like the pinnacle of crime fiction reviewers. The AP canceled the review because they don't have a lot of space during the pandemic for arts coverage. And then she was able to say, Ivy's coming to this bookstore in Florida. Mm-hmm. Let's run the review. And they're going to run it. And it's going to be on the AP Wire. So like, there is this weird silver lining to it. And yeah, like, I love it. You know, I made two bookstore friends, one really great friend at the Poison Pen bookstore in Arizona, because I did an event with him and then he and I did one with someone else and we're emailing and chatting, and not that that wouldn't have happened in person, but I feel like there's some kind of thing that's happening that we've yet to see the benefit of, and it's going to be great going forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. I hope as we come out of this, all these virtual events continue. I went to something at the American Writers Museum in Chicago the other night.
Right.
Who knew there was such
and conferences.
A place?
You know? Yeah, and you can go to conferences that you wouldn't have been able to afford. You know, I know lots of bloggers I know are like, I can now go to these Thriller Fest and all this stuff, not pay for it. Like, I don't like, that's just amazing, you know?
Yeah. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words or advice or anything for the writers listening.
Oh, well, you know, I guess what I would like to say, it's sort of complicated, is that there's no one, I feel like every book I've written, I've been on the show, is this my second or third time? I can't remember.
I think third.
Third, that's, I'm pretty sure it's the third.
Yeah.
Every book comes out differently. So, you know, if it's not working the same way it was the time before, or the short story is not working at the time it was before, it's like all your kids are different. Like, I think that we need to let go that we all have the same process over every single project. And like, if it's your first novel and it's not getting published, start another one and just do it differently. Like, don't expect everything to come the same way. I think for me, really letting go of that idea as I'm starting a new book after These Women, which is a very easy book to write, I'm writing to start a new book that's going to be a hard book to write. I know it's going to be hard. And just like that idea that it's going to be a struggle, but maybe the next one will be easy, has been sort of a relaxing thing. So everything comes out differently.
Mm. Well, Ivy, thank you again so much for,
thanks,
for coming back on the show.
Yeah, of course.
It's been wonderful. And oh, all of you out there, that's it for today. You can find Writers on Writing on iTunes and Stitcher. So if you tuned in late and you want to hear this show again, go there and subscribe. And we'll post it in a few days. So thank you for listening.
Thanks, Barbara.